how well your next flight goes can set the tone for your entire vacation. And understanding how things really work from the perspective of the crew can make your experience as a passenger much more comfortable and reduce the frustration and even the fear on your next flight. That's why we've invited Patrick Smith to join us right now. He's a commercial pilot, and Patrick has written a book called Cockpit Confidential, everything you need to know about air travel. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So when we buckle up and raise our tray tables and raise our seats to their upright and locked position, you're up in the cockpit. What's it like to take off? What goes through your mind? Is there a thrill? Is there a fear? Is there a, oh, no turning back now? What's it like?
Well, for some of us, those of us like me who wanted to fly commercially going as far back as we can remember, you know, there's always a certain thrill each time you leave the ground. That sounds corny, but really it's true. Now, the takeoff itself is a very procedural thing. So you're busy and you're concentrating, but there's always just enough room in the back there for some emotional aspect, I guess, where you're excited to be going.
Do you ever go, woohoo? No?
No.
And I think we should just set the standards here. 25,000 planes take off safely in the United States every day, and it's been more than 10 years since there's been a major commercial airline catastrophe. So record is darn good.
And that's a record going back, by the way, depending how you look at it, at least as far as the advent of the jetliner, and by some statistical interpretation, you could say in the entire history of commercial aviation.
It is astounding how ridiculously safe it is. I mean, thousands of people die every year on the roads, but flying, you got 2 billion flights a year as far as passengers are concerned in the United States, and, you know, it's remarkably safe. You know, just when you get off, I always feel this little cut in the engine or a little bit of a drop, and that always makes my heart tick a little faster. What's going on when you have that engine drop moments after takeoff?
In the book, I call that the climb-out cutback. It's very routine for airplanes to reduce power shortly after takeoff during the initial climb, just as a way of staying slow at that point, because there are certain speed limits below certain altitudes, and as a way of saving engine power. It's really not the sort of deceleration that people interpret it as. The plane is not slowing down. It's just no longer accelerating as quickly.
So you've got off the ground and you've gotten through that barrier. You've kind of crashed through the surf and then you can pull back a little bit. Is that the idea?
That's a decent way to put it, sure.
Basically, just so I understand the situation here, generally planes fly how fast and how high?
The two magic words in commercial aviation are, it depends. I lost track of how many times I had to... Right. Write that in the book, but it really does vary on the type of airplane, the route that you're on, the distance that you're flying, air traffic control constraints, the weight of the aircraft. We could go on and on.
But if I'm flying from Seattle to Chicago and I'm midway through the flight and I look out the window, am I going 600 miles an hour at 30,000 feet or in that ballpark?
Yes, in that ballpark.
Okay.
That's about right.
Now, there's a few points that you brought up in the book that I thought were interesting, and I'd love to share with our listening audience. First of all, a lot of people are concerned about Boeing or Airbus. Is it a matter of style or comfort or safety? Which one is better, and how do airlines judge, you know, what they prefer?
I'm asked this question all the time, Airbus versus Boeing. It's, you know, what it comes down to really is personal preference. It's sort of Apple versus PC, Coke versus Pepsi, if you will. You know, when you start comparing airplane to airplane and wondering which one is safer, you get into this statistical hair splitting that kind of drives me crazy. It's the same when you're doing airline against airline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe on some statistical level, airplane A or airline A is safer than airplane B or airline B. But in a practical sense, they're all safe.
Well, that's good to know. Yeah.
You know, otherwise you're hashing things out to the fifth decimal point.
Right.
And really, if that makes you feel better, go ahead. But there's no real reason to do that. Pick
Good.
Your flight based on price, convenience, and which airline you like, not on which airplane is the one you're going to be flying on. There's really no reason to do that.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're speaking with Patrick Smith. Patrick's been a pilot for over 20 years. He doesn't say what airline he flies for, but he's written an amazing Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel book called Cockpit Confidential. Patrick, a lot of people talk about cabin air, how it's not safe, how it's recycled, how it's gassed so you all are more mellow. What's the truth about cabin air?
Well, the truth, hard as it is for many people to believe, is that the air quality on commercial planes is a lot cleaner than it's given credit for. It's often a lot cleaner than the air in a movie theater or a classroom.
So you guys don't do anything in the crew among flight attendants and pilots to stay healthier because of the air?
No, and there are these urban myths that the pilots tinker with oxygen levels or cut down on the airflow to partly sedate the passengers. I mean, these things are patently ridiculous. That stuff simply doesn't happen.
Okay, that's good to know. And how does a pilot handle red-eye flights? Are you scheduled with jet lag in mind, or do you just get good at overcoming jet lag?
I think you just get good at overcoming it. It's something that, as professionals, we have to deal with, and we get used to it. I fly a lot of long-haul international routes nowadays, and it's just something you expect and have to deal with. You know, I try to rest up before a long-haul flight, a red-eye flight. It's just be ready for it, be rested, try to stay on a good diet, try to exercise, and you can deal with things like that much better.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. And Marianne's on the line in Duluth, Georgia. Marianne, thanks for your call.
Well, thank you so much. And Patrick, I've been enjoying your comments about flying. You remind me of my father, who always taught me to look at the clouds and see how beautiful it is up there. I'm only 61, but I've had a few health issues lately. They've resulted in Coumadin and a need to get up and walk around more often.
So that's to decrease the risk of blood clots.
Correct, correct. Yeah. And while this is not hopefully an ongoing thing, I will be making a trip with my husband and family to Amsterdam and then later in the year to Italy, and wanted to ask, is it okay? I know it's okay to get up and walk around when the lights are off, but do the stewardesses understand? I always worry that I'm going to be infringing on some of the other passengers who might resent my walking around. I just kind of want to get an idea, a feel of what Captain Smith has to say about that.
Well, if the cabin crew are in the middle of a service, then sure, you could potentially get in the way and it could be a little awkward. But I encourage people to get up and walk around when they can to get exercise and to feel better and to reduce the risk of what's called a deep vein thrombosis. That's the clotting phenomena that Rick just alluded to. Some long-haul carriers, Singapore Airlines, for example, they set up a buffet, a snack buffet in the rear of the economy cabin, and on one hand, it's there as a service. On the other hand, though, it encourages people to get up and walk around and reduce the risk of injury.
So that is a good idea. If you're on an 8-hour flight between continents, make a point to get up and walk. I think whether you realize you have a problem or not, it's probably just smart to get up and walk a little bit, as Marianne's suggesting.
Well, I appreciate that very much.
Hey, thanks, Marianne, for your call.
Listen, thank you. Thank you both.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Patrick, your book deals with some fascinating issues that people just are curious about. Let's just go through these pretty briefly and allay some concerns. Why does the airline care about electrical stuff when you're taking off and landing? I can't imagine it really messes things up in the cockpit. Well, although I was on a bus once and my driver said you're not supposed to use the cell phone, and I turned my cell phone on in the back of the tour bus. Later on, he showed me in the little wheel that measured all of his speed. It all went haywire when I turned my cell phone on. So my little cell phone on the tour bus did have an impact on his control panel at the front of the bus. Is that what they're concerned about airplane?
Look, it's unlikely that a cellular phone is going to cause some sort of disruption in the cockpit, but it's not impossible. Mm-hmm. And there have been cases in the past, at least three that I know of, where cell phone interference may have been a factor in an accident. There was a case in Switzerland and at least two others. This is going back a number of years, and again, it's not likely, but it's not impossible. There's a lot that we just don't know, and I think
better safe than sorry.
Yeah, I think the airlines and regulators for now are just erring on the safe side. And ultimately, you know, maybe what it really is a social issue, and airlines just don't want to get to a point where all of a sudden hundreds of people are talking on airplanes, and it sets up this, one group of people hating the other group of people, and
right, I'd vote for
it
that.
It becomes a mess, and they just don't want to go there.
Does a cell phone actually work from 30,000 feet in an airplane?
No, it doesn't.
Okay. Why can't airlines find a faster way to get the boarding procedure done? It just seems ridiculous.
It is pretty chaotic and haphazard at times.
I mean, if everybody just walked in and kept their luggage on their lap until everybody was on the airplane, and then they would say, okay, now stick it upstairs, you could board the plane in a third of the time.
It's gotten better, though. It has, especially now that airlines have moved to what they call zone or group seating.
Yeah, that's an improvement.
And one thing people can do to make the process easier, and this is something I talk about in the book, it drives me crazy when somebody walks onto an airplane, sticks their rollerboard bag into the first empty bin that they come to, and then go and take their seat in the very back of the plane. It's tempting when you see that empty bin as soon as you walk on, but what happens is the forward bins fill up, and then people coming on late who are seated in the front can't find bin space and have to go backwards down the aisle to stow their belongings. And it creates this logjam.
And then when you're
leaving. On arrival, the same thing happens in reverse, where people who are seated up front have to go backwards to get their things before disembarking.
I hadn't thought of that. That causes a horrible mess.
I wish the carriers would make an announcement, just reminding people, please use the bins closest to your seats, or maybe even assigning a bin the way they assign a seat number. Maybe at some point that could be tried and see if it works.
Your attention, please. Your attention, please. Your attention, please. Indian Airlines announces the departure of their flight IC-408 to Calcutta. Passengers are requested to proceed to the aircraft.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. I'm speaking with Patrick Smith, and Patrick's been a pilot for 20 years, taking us where we need to go safely and comfortably on an airline he will not name, because he's written a very candid book about the airline industry, everything you need to know about air travel. It's called Cockpit Confidential. Patrick, this is a travel show, and you travel for a living. When you're sitting in the cockpit, 30,000 feet above the earth, going 600 miles an hour, do you have a joy of travel in any way? And if so, describe it to us. What's a beautiful moment, just from a, wow, I'm traveling point of view for a pilot?
Well, you know, I think that I'm different from most airline pilots in that it's not merely the hands-on thrill of driving the airplane that excites me. It's where the airplane is going. And I feel very privileged nowadays to be able to fly a lot of long-haul international routes, flying to Europe and South America and Africa and the Middle East. I mean, that to me is what makes my job exciting. When I was a little kid, I used to study not airplanes, but the airlines. I would open timetables and look at the route maps, and that in turn turned me on to geography. And I got interested in foreign places and foreign cultures, and putting the two together, kind of the love of flying and the love of places. You know, I think I'm in a great spot where I'm able to visit, you know, countries all around the world as part of my job. I mean, how cool is that?
That's very cool. And, of course, you're excited to be going to Rio or Paris or wherever. But when you're actually up in the air and you see a little mountain peeking through the clouds or a special view of a sunset across the ocean, what are some of the majestic scenes just to be there in the moment when you're in the cockpit?
There's a segment in the book where I talk about some of my favorite views from aloft, flying over Greenland, for example. And that's something that transatlantic travelers can experience all the time. A lot of the transatlantic flights, depending on the routing, will often pass over the southern part of Greenland. And the view can be so amazing, and it's depressing because you look around the cabin and everybody's got their shades down. Nobody bothers to look outside, where if you took a peek, you'd see this incredible vista of glaciers and mountains. It almost looks like another planet. Flying over parts of Guyana in South America and looking down on one of the last intact large-scale tracts of virgin rainforest left in the world, where Brazil and Guyana and Venezuela come together as one of the few real frontiers left on the planet. And you can look down from an airplane, and granted, you're not down there in it, but you can see it. It's right there. At the opening of the segment, Rick, you touched on the passengers lost appreciation, let's call it, for flying. You know, I don't want to say there's a sense of entitlement out there among passengers, but it's something like that. You know, let's look first at fares. There was a study that came out not too long ago that showed that airfares are 50% on average less right now than they were 30 years ago. That's pretty amazing. I mean, once upon a time, it cost $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 to fly to Europe.
Right.
flying coast to coast in the U.S. was thousands of dollars. Flying was something that not everybody could do. And that's completely different now. It's now a form of mass transit,
yeah,
for lack of a better term. And while, you know, that has meant a lot of the amenities and the grace of the experience, you know, is somewhat gone, on the other hand, it's something now that everybody can do and almost everybody can afford. And people don't often acknowledge that.
You know, it's easy to complain about it, but you're right. They're complaining about a time when it was an upper-class activity and it cost double what it costs now in real dollars. I remember when point-to-point flights in Europe were just unaffordable. Nobody who's spending their own money would ever fly point-to-point in Europe. You'd take the train. Now, it's actually cheaper to fly than it is to take the train almost any long flight.
And people talk about the good old days of flying, and I think there's a certain mythology to that. You know, I flew the other night from Tokyo to Bangkok, and I was sitting in economy class, and I had a seat. Granted, maybe once upon a time I had another inch or two of legroom, but in this seat I had a 13-inch video monitor with a touch screen and a choice of about 150 movies to watch. And remember the days when movies were shown on that blurry, scratchy screen up in front of the bulkhead and you had the plastic earplugs that dug into your head? You've got Wi-Fi on airplanes now. The meal I had on that flight to Bangkok was probably better than the meal I would have had 30 years ago in economy class.
Yeah.
You know, all of that for, you know, the equivalent of maybe 5 or 6 cents per mile, mm-hmm, in fares. And meanwhile, about 85% or so of commercial flights arrive on time.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't even gotten to safety yet, where you've got this spectacularly good safety record. So, you know, here we are.
And, Patrick, you have to put up with 20 minutes of TSA sort of silliness. And, okay, that's a small price to pay to be safe and economic and get around the world almost effortlessly at 600 miles an hour.
Flying is affordable, it's mostly reliable, and it's astonishingly safe. Those three things taken together, you know, what more can you want? Is it really that bad of a way to go? That's not to say that the hassles of flying aren't duly noted.
Mm-hmm.
You just touched on TSA. Mm-hmm. Noisy airports, crying babies, airlines that may not always be the best communicators when it comes to relaying problems and delays to passengers, but...
Patrick, I always like to look out the window down at the earth below and imagine being on a bus going where I'm going today and what that would be like instead. And then I don't care how tight my knees are. I don't care how much there isn't a lunch and how tired I am of those little packets of peanuts. I'm happy to be on that airplane. Patrick Smith, author of Cockpit Confidential, thanks a lot and best wishes with your flying.
Thank you, Rick.
We'll keep the phones open a bit longer and check in with listeners who've got travel reports of their own to share with us at 877-333-RICK about how they enjoy experiencing the world at any age. It's Travel with Rick Steves.